Welcome to the Land Use, Transportation, and Infrastructure Committee meeting of Denver City Council. Full coverage of this session of the Land Use, Transportation, and Infrastructure Committee begins now.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Land Use, Transportation, and Infrastructure Committee on July 8th. We have one action item and one briefing and, my goodness, nine consent items. My name is Darrell Watson. I'm honored to serve as the chair of the Land Use Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. And to kick us off, and I turn it over to my fellow council members for introductions. Starting on my right.
Chris Hines, Denver's Perfect 10.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Hello. Good afternoon. Diana Romero Campbell, Southeast Denver, District 4.
Laura Alvidres, Lucky District 7.
Paul Cashman, South Denver, District 6.
Jamie Torres, West Denver, District 3.
And Chris Hines, nice haircut.
Thanks.
So first on the docket is a rezoning. Matthew Bosler, I think it's queued up for you. I'll turn it over to you for the presentation.
Thank you, Guzman. Good afternoon. My name is Matthew Bosler, and I'm a senior city planner and urban designer from the Community Planning and Development Department. Today, I'm presenting a rezoning request for 801 15th Street. This is an applicant-driven application to request a zone district that allows for large format sign installations. Starting with the request, the subject property is a little over a quarter acre in size on the northern corner of the intersection of Stout and 15th. The property is occupied by Home 2 Suites, a high-rise hotel building. The request is to rezone the property from DC UO1 to DTD UO1. DC stands for Downtown Core, while DTD stands for Downtown Theater District. Each of these are in the downtown neighborhood context and contain identical standards related to the building form, height, and use, with the exception being that the DTD allows for large format sign installations, according to additional standards of the Denver Theater District sign plan. UO1 is the adult use overlay district, which is not proposed to be changed with this rezoning. The purpose of the rezoning, as stated in the application narrative, is to allow digital signage with off-site advertising in a manner that serves as a gateway to the theater district. So taking a closer look at the location and context of the property, zooming out, the property is located in Council District 10. Denver's Perfect 10 is, of course, represented by Councilman Chris Hines. The statistical neighborhood is the Central Business District. And in regards to signage, the existing zoning downtown center zone district allows for signs permitted in all districts. One constraint on signage that it shares with the DTD is a maximum illumination of 25 watts or less per bulb. The existing district, as I mentioned earlier, also contains the UO1. The existing land use is commercial slash hotel, and it lies within a diverse matrix of land uses in the surrounding blocks. The existing building on the right here is a high rise with contemporary cladding. The ground floor is a lobby and retail units with high transparency. The next five floors are a screened parking garage, and above that are hotel rooms. As you can see on the left, looking down Stout Street is an important gateway view for pedestrians approaching the Colorado Convention Center from 16th Street. Along this view, there is a terminal vista to the Convention Center's primary entrance. The existing and proposed zone districts, as mentioned earlier, are the same, but with the major difference that the DTD allows special types of signs, including billboards, as further regulated by the Denver Theater District sign plan, the cover of which you see here. This sign plan sets standards for high-quality design, for mitigation of impacts to neighboring land uses, and a revenue-sharing program that supports public art in the district. So with that frame of reference, let's review the rezoning process. We posted informational notice of the application on April 9th, planning board notice on May 20th, and the planning board public hearing occurred on June 4th. At this hearing, nine people spoke, all in favor. Planning board voted unanimously to recommend approval. Some of the questions and ensuing discussion revolved around the origin of the theater district boundaries, clarification that a public hearing will occur as part of the district sign plan amendment process, and the relationship between this rezoning and the billboard use overlay. In addition, the planning board encouraged the city to consider a more comprehensive approach to future changes to the DTD boundary. Staff noted that this is being considered through the downtown area plan update process that is ongoing. So we're here today at the Land Use, Transportation, and Infrastructure Committee, and a city council public hearing is tentatively scheduled on August 18th. We've received two public comments from residents of the Spire condominiums to the west. One is opposed, expressing concerns for the impact of light on their sleep and therefore their health. The other expressed similar concerns and asked for more information, which I provided. In addition, the applicant received letters of support from the Denver Theater District, Colorado Convention Center, Downtown Denver Partnership, and the Upper Downtown Neighborhood Association. Taking a look at the review criteria, we have consistency with adopted plans, that the rezoning be in the public interest, and consistency with neighborhood context, zone district purpose, and intent. For plan consistency, we have three plans to consider: comp plan, blueprint, and the downtown area plan. While there's no direct mention of large format sign installations in comp plan, there are several goals that pertain to this rezoning. The first of these is to enhance Denver's neighborhoods through high quality urban design. The next comp plan goal that the proposed rezoning aligns with is to accelerate economic vitality through the arts, culture, and creativity. And lastly, the proposal aligns with a comp plan goal to expand participation in the arts. Similarly to comp plan, blueprint also does not mention large format signage, but several maps and recommendations are worth considering as they relate to this rezoning. Starting with the maps, the subject property is in the downtown neighborhood context. Its future place is Regional Center. The future street type of both Stout Street and 15th Street is downtown arterial. And lastly, the subject property lies within the Regional Center growth area's strategy. All of these highly urban categories align with allowance of off-site advertising through the protections of the district sign plan. In addition, Blueprint also includes a couple of policies that should be considered with the proposed rezoning. The first of these is the quality of life infrastructure goal, which has several supportive strategies, one of which is to ensure attractive streets in centers and corridors. And another is to is guidance to work with private partners to increase access to entertainment. The second goal from Blueprint that's relative to this case, or pertinent to this case, I should say, is the land use and built form goal. There's a policy supporting this goal that emphasizes resource-efficient practices for design and construction of buildings. So while this rezoning changes nothing about building technology, contemporary electronic signage is resource-efficient in comparison to the incandescent bulbs of the past. Moving on, the downtown area plan explicitly describes the theater district, but the guidance it provides is limited and a bit fuzzy. This plan from 2007 was the original city document recommending establishment of the theater district. And in the same year, the DTD was enacted in code, separating it from DC zoning. So while this plan is light on details, it describes a conceptual boundary between the theater district and the visitor district. What you see here is the plan's development concept map. The subject property, which is where the red arrow is pointing, is at the edge of where the two come together. Further details on how this boundary is described in the plan are in the staff report. Another strategy of the downtown area plan that is consistent with the proposed rezoning is strengthening downtown Denver as the downtown of the Rocky Mountain region. A specific policy identified within this strategy is to create a brand identity that promotes downtown. Another policy supporting the strategy is to cultivate arts and culture as key economic drivers by expanding the clusters of world-class arts, cultural, and performance facilities in downtown. As a baseline, A bright lights district created by on-premise advertising can contribute to the vitality of an arts and cultural district. Above this, the more creative signage outcomes in off-site advertising that we can expect as a result of the DTD district sign plan and subsequent review processes could potentially contribute to this vitality as well. In addition, there is a significant anticipated positive impact on arts investments in the public realm resulting from the revenue sharing requirement. So, in summary, staff finds that the proposed rezoning is consistent with the downtown area plan based on consideration of the plan's development concept map and strategies, in that it would likely contribute to public safety, pedestrian comfort, economic vitality, and overall energizing of the theater district as a special place unique from other districts in the commercial core of the city. Staff finds that the proposed rezoning to minorly grow the DTD signage program in an appropriate visitor-rich location in the city's entertainment core meets the second review criteria as well, in that it is consistent with the vision, strategies, and recommendations of adopted plans, which are essentially centered on the public good. And lastly, staff finds that the proposed rezoning is consistent with neighborhood context, zone district, purpose, and intent, which is further detailed in the staff report. So with all this in mind, CPD recommends approval of this proposed rezoning based on meeting all the criteria. Both me and the applicant are here to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Matthew. And if our production team, there you go, would take down the slide presentation. We have several members in the queue, and Councilmember Hines, since this is in the perfect 10, I'll start with you.
Thank you. Mr. Bosler, thank you for the presentation. When you say off-site, what does it mean to have an off-site sign?
So an off-site sign, which is kind of the special allowance here in the district or elsewhere in the billboard use overlay district, is advertising for a business that does not have a presence on the site itself.
So the sign is on site. It is the advertisement is when you say off site, it's not the physical structure. It is the content could be for things that are not directly related to the property, like a motel or hotel.
Exactly.
Got it. Yep. Okay. Sweet. I think it's kind of important context for people to know that by granting this zoning change, it doesn't mean that they can advertise in Aurora or Kansas or whatever. The physical presence is actually on site. It's just that they can advertise for things that aren't necessarily on the premise. Like maybe they could advertise for the Performing Arts Complex or the Colorado Symphony, or things that are related to the theater district. Is that the thought?
Yes, that's accurate. I think of the signs that you see in the theater district today, some of them do advertise upcoming performances within the district, but they also advertise products, for example, or services elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the clarification. Mm-hmm. Thank you to the applicant for making this application. You are a trailblazer, as in there are other properties that have seen you apply and also want to apply. So I think it's, as we consider changing zoning for various properties, I think it's, important for us to use adopted plans. It's a little unfortunate that we're in the process of working on the downtown area plan, and we might just be a few months off from the new one. I would say that 2007 plan is not the oldest plan in the book, but it's certainly not the newest either. And I would agree that this is consistent with the current adopted plans. I would say we're having a lot of conversation right now with the new neighborhood planning initiative and the new the new plan for downtown. And I would say it is my estimation. Again, we haven't adopted it yet, so it shouldn't be an official part of the legally required review criteria. But I think it's important for us to know where we're going to and see if this is in line where we're going? And I would say, I think the answer is yes, just for those who are interested. I think that in part of, we've got a gem in our performing arts complex, with the second largest performing arts complex in the nation behind New York City. And we don't really advertise that as much, even though we have people come from all over the U.S. and beyond to events right in our theater district. And so one of the conversations that we're having with the new downtown area plan is how do we lean into the performing arts complex that we have, and how do we connect it to 16th Street? How do we connect it to Upper Downtown? How do we connect it to Union Station? So that we have better connectivity throughout our center city. Our center city are two neighborhoods. We have 78 in the in the entire city. We've got CBD and Lodo. A lot of people come to those two neighborhoods, and those are the, when I say CBD and Lodo, those are the statistical names of the neighborhoods. But Lower Downtown and Upper Downtown, as some people would kind of commonly refer to them, or in many ways everyone's neighborhood. All 78 or 76 neighborhoods come to these two and find entertainment. And so I really am excited that we're thinking about our center city, our downtown, how we can connect the performing arts complex to other areas downtown, and expanding the theater district, I think, is one way for us to do that. So while you're applying because you want a sign, I think part of the downtown area plan conversation is how can we lean into the theater district to make it more than just downtown plus a sign. So I hope that you're along for that ride, because I think it'll be a very important and formative one for the theater district. And I think that's, if I'm understanding correctly, that's kind of part of the reason why you want to apply. It's not just so that you can have a sign that advertises for things other than your hotel. And actually, if you wouldn't mind going to the microphone, introducing yourself, figure I might as well have you on record.
Thank you, Councilman. Hi, everyone. I'm Matthew Nelson. I'm a legal counsel for the applicant. I believe the applicant might be also joining via Zoom as well. Anna Behrman from Orange Barrel Media. And you're absolutely correct. We've worked with staff throughout the application process and discussed whether we move this application forward before the downtown area plan is complete or after it's complete, and in coordination with staff, decided to move it forward first, essentially as a pilot. It's our understanding that as part of the downtown area plan update, the downtown Denver, the Denver Theater District boundaries will likely expand, exactly like you said, to highlight the gem that is the Denver Performing Arts Center and 16th Street and the other cultural amenities of the city. And we're happy to be along for the ride.
Yeah, super. Yeah, so I think this meets the legally required review criteria. And I would say on top of that, I think as we have the conversation about how our center city breathes with the neighborhoods around it, also the various areas within these two statistical neighborhoods, how they breathe, and make sure that people can get easily and safely from the Performing Arts Complex to 16th Street to Union Station to Civic Center Station, and away to wherever their home might be. So I like it. So thank you for your application. I'll certainly be voting to move this forward, and we'll be voting for it on the floor.
Thank you, Councilmember Hines. And the legal counsel, do you mind stating the name of the applicant again? And I just want to see if we need to promote this person in case there are questions from council.
Yes, the applicant is Anna Behrman with Orange Barrel Media.
Okay, and we'll move to Councilmember Torres, but I just want to check with our team to see if that person is online. I'm seeing head shaking, no.
It may also be Kyra Schneider.
Is there a Kyra Schneider? There may not be questions, but I just want to make sure if there are, that we are able to promote. Yes, do you mind promoting? And we'll turn to Councilmember Torres for additional questions.
Thank you so much. Maybe I'll just start with CPD on the designation of something going into theater district. Because it sounds like the only difference is the permission of a billboard or or digital signage. Are there other differences?
No, there is an allowance for flashing signs, but it's a moot point for this particular site because it's not adjacent to 16th Street.
Okay.
That would be the only other major difference.
And for the signage that the theater district allows, is it also for static, like billboards, or is it digital changing signage?
It's for all forms of off-site advertising, okay. So static and digital.
Are there other regulations around size?
There are, yes. Within the sign plan itself, there are actually, if you don't mind, if we could pull the presentation back up. I can go to one of the alternate slides.
Sure.
So there are several pages in the theater district sign plan that both describe where a sign should occur or where there should be a concentration or not so much concentration of signs, and that's what you see here in this map. But there's also a page for every single building frontage that signs are allowed to be on. And within each building, every facade of that building, every portion of that facade either has a yes or no, basically. And that yes or no is assigned to specific sign types. The zoning code also has constraints on the overall size of the signs.
Okay.
But the district sign plan itself doesn't get into the size okay. so much. It's really more so the location.
So but there is something that helps check based on your building or what you've built. Here's the signage that you can put on it.
Yeah, okay. To state it a different way, the zoning code has specific dimensional requirements. And then in addition to that, the design standards, if you will, or review criteria that each sign application will be considered against by staff and by the nonprofit Denver Theater District, that includes a requirement that it not adversely impact residential uses. And one of the specific means by which the plan describes that adverse impact potentially occurring is by a sign dominating an area by virtue of its size.
Yeah.
And so there's both a kind of a hard and fast area requirement that the zoning reviewer will apply, and there's also some discretion that the urban design reviewer and the theater district can apply as well.
Okay. I'm looking, and it's just on the Google's Street View, the difference between the signage that's on the spire, for example, versus like a wrapping signage that's on the DCPA parking garage, and like what's allowed where is probably determined by what you're describing.
Yes. All signs also are limited to the second story or above,
okay.
but more specifically back to the individual pages per building that kind of draws out boxes of where those signs can occur. So while I'm not 100% sure, I could probably find a page right here that shows a box where the existing sign is, or the sign itself is smaller than the box that is allowed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have information about how much revenue goes to the theater district from the signage, or is that the applicant?
Yes, okay. Yes. So if it is an off-site advertising, then 15% of the revenue goes to the theater district to support public art performances, public art in the public realm, or marketing by the theater district itself.
Does it go, so who is the district, and is that different from the Denver Center for Performing Arts?
It is. So there is a nonprofit, it's the Denver Theater District, and they both have the responsibility as charged by the sign plan to have a supplementary review in addition to staff, but they also organize all of the public art that occurs within the district, as well as coordinating with applicants on the placement of signage.
And does the theater district operate like a maintenance district or anything like that? It is just art, and is it art in that district, or is it art citywide that they support?
On the latter point, it's just art within the district boundaries. That's kind of, that 15% revenue is confined to the area within the theater district. The first question was, could you repeat it again?
The money that they earn, what it goes toward, I think was my only question there.
So the money, yes, can go towards things such as, if you guys remember the blue trees on 16th Street Mall, I think that was an example of monies went towards that. The lighting of the clock tower. There's time allocated on digital signage for public art before it rotates to the next ad.
Yeah.
Those are some examples of the public art. That.
And then on-site advertising are publicizing things that take place within the theater district.
On-site?
Yeah.
Yes. So on-site.
In that building.
Well, specifically on-site advertising would be for within the building itself.
It is.
Yes.
Right. So leasing opportunities or something
could be.
Like that.
Yeah, but okay. More often it would be like the business itself,
the
right? Like if it was a hotel, for example. So Home2 Suites, if they erected a sign that was just Home2 Suites, then there would be no revenue generated, external revenue generated by that. It's just driving into the business that's located on site.
Okay.
So that would be an example of your
on-site. And there's no requirement for X amount of off-site versus on-site. It's just whatever, like they could 100% of the time advertise on-site ads and then no money goes to the theater district.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Could they 100% of the time advertise on-site ads? Or is there a requirement that they do some off-site advertisements in order for the theater district to earn revenue?
Yeah, that is a very good question. So I guess I believe, and I'm not 100% sure on this, but I believe the definition of on-site signage includes advertisement for products and services sold within the business. So in other words, it's not just the name of the business, Home2 Suites. They could potentially, I believe, advertise a special rate on rooms, for example.
But I guess I'm wondering, is there a potential for the theater district to get no money from the billboard's new option to revenue generate? And maybe you know an answer to that.
Matthew?
I don't believe there's a regulation related to it, but it is the applicant's standard practice. Approximately 45% of the sign time is dedicated to either on-site, so in this case, the Home2 Suites building, or public art, so both local artists, national artists. The applicant has a community development team that partners with artists. They've done that on the other signs throughout the Denver Theater District, and then 55% of the remaining is typically dedicated to off-site advertisements. And
is there any arrangement with the theater district nonprofit for like X amount of our time will be dedicated to the revenue generating that the theater district would benefit from?
Yeah, that's a great question. If Kyra is on, I believe I had a thumbs up that she was. She might know that answer.
I'll also interject that David Ehrlich, who is the director of the Denver Theater District, is also online. He could probably answer that as well.
Either one would be great.
Yeah. That question.
Kyra, before you jump in, if you don't mind introducing yourself, the organization you're with, and then respond.
Yes, my name is Kara Schneider. I'm the Senior Business Development Manager at Ike Smart City. So representing Ike Smart City and Orange Barrel Media. So representing Orange Barrel Media on this particular project.
Kara, did you hear my question?
Do you mind repeating it? I think David Ehrlich also is joining, and he might be able to help me with that as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, wait. Hi, David. Either one of you, if you have an answer to the question around whether there's any arrangement or agreement between the theater district and the applicant about, it's like you're nodding your head, David. Do you already have the answer? Go ahead.
Yeah, David. Once again, introduce yourself, please, and then answer the question.
David Ehrlich, Executive Director of the Denver Theater District. It's actually a very good question, a very subtle question. The bottom line is every media company that participates in the theater district signs a services agreement It's a contract that outlines their obligations to us in the community. So, for example, if the light is too bright, they have to turn it down within a certain period of time, within, you know, minutes or hours, as opposed to normal business. And they have to get in touch with people who've complained. And if they don't, that's a breach of contract. That's one example. Another example was your terrific question. If someone builds a sign and they only do on-site promotion, so if they only promote the hotel, there is value to that. And we would have an accountant come in, value the promotional value of that on-premises signage, and we would still get our 15% revenue share from the media company for that. So to answer your question, the bottom line is, yes, we would still get a revenue allocation. There would just be a fair market analysis of what that was worth. I think hopefully that answers the question, but it's a great question. So in either case, we essentially get the revenue. And as Matt said, that revenue then goes to all the art activities you see, the DNF Tower, Kitteridge Projection. We did an art cave with local artists this winter that drew 3,000 people downtown. So these installations are really the key to us being able to do all that art on the street in downtown.
Okay, that does answer my question. Thank you so much for that info. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Torres, for asking those questions. Council President Pro Tem Romero Campbell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will the signs have the same requirements that other existing signs have, like for lettering and pictures? Like, does it roll into kind of the existing sign requirements?
There are some existing sign requirements that would apply to the site, particularly for signs such as projecting signs or wall signs, basically building identification signs, if you will, right? So those would still be regulated by the DZC in the same way. The offsite ads themselves are regulated both by the DZC and by the theater district sign plan. So there's a supplemental set of standards that apply to those signs.
Thank you. And then I have another question. I don't know if you've already answered this, but are the signs attached to the building, or could somebody build something right next to the building, like an independent structure, and then attach it? I'm trying to visualize like what this looks like, or if the building should come down, then does the sign that was erected next to a building exist?
That is a good question, and I'm not sure if I know the answer specifically, but I can say that there is that requirement that the signs be above the second floor. So for offsite ads, at least, I believe that would exclude ground signs that were separated from the building. With that being said, there are kiosks within the Denver Theater District that are on the sidewalk in the public realm that include ads as well as orientation throughout the district. So I'm not exactly sure how those are characterized or qualify within the code, but perhaps that's something that David might be able to answer more specifically.
And David, I was going to ask, if you're still promoted, we can have the question re-asked. Council President Pro Tem, do you mind asking that question again?
Yeah. So the question is, are these signs attached to the building? Or if they aren't attached to the building, is there something that would be like erected adjacent to the building and attached? I'm thinking of some of the signs that are grandfathered in or that have existed before that are very tall signs. The building goes away, but the sign then is grandfathered in until but I just wondered, like, are these required to be attached to the building or are they separate?
So no, it's a good question. In the theater district, you're not allowed to do rooftop signage. And primarily the signs, I think almost exclusively, are attached to the building. In this case, it's attached to the building. And therefore, if there's an issue with the building coming down, the sign comes down. So we have very few. There are two on Spear Boulevard, but they're on city property. that are standalone signs. But in thinking about it, I think the majority, I think every one of our signs is attached. And so therefore, you avoid the situation where you have a lease for a sign, the building goes away, and then you're just left with a sign. So we avoid that. And long-winded way of saying, yes, this is attached to the building.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Those were my questions.
Sure. Thank you, Council President Pro Tem. Final question from Councilmember Hines, and I'll look around the room and see if there's anyone else jumping in the queue. Councilmember Hines?
Yeah, thank you, Committee Chair. Just one other thing about how this is everyone's neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, part of the reason why it's everyone's neighborhood is you have features in these two downtown statistical neighborhoods that really you don't want in all 78 neighborhoods. But it's creating a sense of a grander presentation. I mean, this is this is where people can go back home where the street lights are not as bright as downtown, and rightfully so. We wouldn't want these signs in Congress Park. We wouldn't want these signs, and of this scale, but that's part of the excitement of living downtown or visiting downtown, and so I recognize that this might be concerning to some who live downtown. I live downtown, and boy, isn't it great that I don't have to get in a car and drive to or even leave my home. Frankly, I can, the concerts that were in Civic Center Park over the weekend, I just opened up the balcony door and could hear them without even leaving home. That's one of the both blessing, everywhere you live is a blessing and a curse. The blessing is that I didn't have to go anywhere to hear the same music, the same performances that people flew in from out of state to go attend. And so, that is the blessing and the curse of downtown. But I would say I want there to be a theater district that resembles Broadway. I want there to be a sense of wonderment where people can go and see digital signs that they wouldn't see in their own neighborhood. But that's what we do downtown, is we have things at scale that we would not want in our own neighborhood. But that's why people come to visit downtown. So I sure hope that the theater district zoning becomes more than just downtown core plus signs. That's part of what we're studying with the downtown area plan. So just thought I'd mention, because there were some reservations about lighting. I recognize that. It's good to know Mr. Ehrlich verified that that there is a complaint process that that is expedited in this case, should the signs be too bright. So I think we have some protection for our downtown neighbors, but that's what we get for living downtown, is being next to all these things that people come from all over the world to visit. So just thought I'd add that comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Councilmember Hines. This is an action item, and I want to thank Matthew and CPD and everyone for your presentation and your comments from the folks that are online. Do we have a motion moved by Hines, seconded by Councilmember Torres? Do we need additional discussion on this? Thumbs up for this move to the floor. Great job. Thank you so much, Matthew, and everyone for your presentation. We have a briefing, and as we're transitioning to the briefing for expanding housing ability, we will take a quick pause. And Emily, I'll give you a quick moment. Let me know when you feel like you're situated, and then we can start in on your briefing.
I'm ready when you are.
You are ready. You're a professional. Emily, I'll turn it over to you for your presentation.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon, members of LUDI. And I'm here to provide you with the final report out. It's very exciting. On the expanding housing affordability grace period. So as always, I'd like to start with a little bit of background to refresh ourselves on this ordinance, which City Council initially approved on June 8th of 2022 and went into effect on July 1st of that year. It requires projects to comply depending on the scope. So anything 10 units or more now is required to provide income-restricted units on site or pay a fee in lieu. And all other non-residential projects or projects between 1 and 9 units are subject to increased linkage fees assessed with their building permit. In order to be eligible for the pre-EHA applicability and be subject to the grace period, a project had to have submitted a concept prior to June 30th of 2022 and also have their associated site development plan approved by April 18th of this year. That deadline of the site development plan or SDP approval essentially was the city staff signature on their electronic Mylar. That is what final approval constituted. We've discussed the grace period several times, and council has changed the grace period deadline 3 times, mainly in response to the city review backlog and to allow adequate time for applicants who submitted by June 30th to obtain their approvals. The original deadline was August 30th of 2023. Staff came back to council, and we were granted an extension in May of 2023. It created a split deadline. Most projects were subject to an August 31st, 2024 deadline or December of that year if the project included subdivision or large development plan review. As we approached those deadlines, we realized we still had a very large queue of projects, so we came back requesting one final extension, which was granted in May of 2024. So at that time, council approved the final deadline for April 18th of 2025. And also instituted a 90-day inactivity period for those remaining projects. And that is a reduction from the typical 180-day inactivity period that would normally apply to projects and is in our codes. So during the last few years, we have employed several outreach strategies for that remaining queue of projects to spur them into motion and get them approved, if at all possible. So starting in June of 2024, we sent monthly email correspondence to all contacts with an active application, reminding them of the deadline. Starting in January of this year, we bumped that up to weekly email correspondence. In February, we sent out a phone correspondence with directions and options to contact me if they had questions, and then we could figure out, you know, what they needed to do to move forward. In June, we also started contacting the high review cycle projects, so anything that was beyond 5 to 6 cycles, and we discussed their critical pathways to approval. The site design and neighborhood development team maintained monthly focus weeks since 2023, in which we would send out their list of pre-EHA projects for them to prioritize and complete those reviews and get comments back to the applicant teams. I also conducted inactivity tracking manually for both the 180 days and then for the 90-day periods, and would send individual correspondence to those teams, notifying them of their 30-day threshold, essentially, until their project would close. So what we're all here for, the big reveal. We started with over 1,500 records, and this is the overall status. And note, this did include all concepts, site development plan amendments, modifications, anything that we had in the queue that was also before that June 30th deadline that might have already been in the works. So it captured all of that, plus that huge influx in concept applications right before that deadline. But you can see we had 628 records. This is just records approved. And then a very large number that closed due to inactivity, and then several others that were either closed complete, closed withdrawn, et cetera. So to get into some of the nuance of those records, we only had 10 projects that did not meet the deadline. So these 10 projects did have an active site development plan in review, and they did not achieve city staff signatures on their electronic Mylars by the deadline. These 10 records had not submitted. The last time I checked, they were all from February, March is the last time that they had gotten comments, and they had not even resubmitted. So they weren't really attempting at that point to get those final comments addressed. So Those were the 10. And that you can see that 9 of them were still kind of in that review. And one of the projects was a modification out in District 11, and they just did not submit their Mylars. So the impact to that project is minimal. It was nothing that changed the scope of the pre-approved project, but they do need to finish and get their Mylar signed. As for projects that were inactive or withdrawn, that was 46% of our projects. So provided the breakdown here, that was 225 concepts that just did not move forward, and then 464 site development plans that closed due to inactivity or were withdrawn by the applicant teams. But we did achieve a 53% approval rate. So that was 192 concepts, right, that moved into that formal review. But really the more important aspect here is the 635 site development plans. So those are projects that intend to move forward with their development plans and move into the building permitting phase and develop their project. So we're really happy with 53%. We thought that was a great success, considering the high volume of projects that we had. And lastly, we just broke down those approved projects by council district in case you were interested to see where those numbers kind of balanced out. We know from the earlier report outs that several districts were kind of hit hardest with some of that volume. 7, 9, 10, 11 were some of the big ones that got a lot of applications in the door. So you can see how many projects at the end of the day were approved in your district. And that is all that I have for you today as for the final report out on the status of those projects. Happy to answer any questions. And I also have support here from host as well.
Thank you so much, Emily. We are not a competitive group, but you know, put a graph up with our council districts where like, what? Where are we at? So I appreciate it. We do have a queue that has formed. And so up front first is Councilmember Alvidres, followed by Torres and Hines.
Thank you, Committee Chair. Thank you for this report out. Something that would be helpful since you ended on that last slide is how many were canceled per district as well. I also wanted to ask if there was any questions or surveying of canceled projects of why they didn't move forward.
Not a formal one, but most of the time applicants said that just due to market conditions, they decided not to move forward with their project.
I think having that data instead of anecdotal would be helpful if we could survey them and ask them, because obviously we're in a housing crisis and that's a lot of potential units of housing that disappeared. How many staff were assigned to handle this load of EHA-specific projects?
Well, several different departments are involved, so I don't have an exact number of staff.
From CPD.
How many are in SD&D at this point? 7.
7. And did that number go up or down or stay at 7 like the majority of this time since the deadline was approaching?
I'll defer to Chris to answer the staffing question.
Good afternoon. Chris Gleisner, Community Planning and Development. I'm our director for Site Design and Neighborhood Development. Our Site Design and Neighborhood Development team is typically staffed by 7 project coordinators, is typically the language that you will hear. It is currently 6, so that number did drop about halfway through last year. But given our abilities and the progress we were making catching up on our backlog, that position has not been refilled. But we were able to, again, get through that 1,559 projects with staff that we had been budgeted previously.
And as we close out, are those staff moving to different projects, or what happens with those staff members that were dedicated to the EHA?
So that's a great question. Those staff members are dedicated to the entirety of their workload, so they still have workload of all the other projects that have continued to come in. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So they weren't dedicated like to a EHA project specifically?
Correct. They were not solely focused on EHA. EHA was a portion of their work queue.
Okay, that's helpful. How are we tracking post-EHA housing starts and how they compare to pre-EHA levels?
Well, I am maintaining a spreadsheet of all of the approved site plans and tracking the status of their building permit. because they do technically, per Denver zoning code, have an expiration date in order to obtain a building permit and start construction. So we'll be tracking that. And then we do periodic data pulls of what you might consider post-EHA projects, right, that have submitted concept or are in SDP. And that's partially what, you know, HOST is helping to monitor. So we're always looking at, you know, outcomes for mandatory affordable housing, et cetera. But by housing starts, I mean, this wouldn't include like single family development, right? It would just include multifamily primarily, but we can always do analysis given a date to look before and after.
Yeah, I think it would be helpful to have to measure the success of this policy and how it's working and how it has impacted our housing supply and development. I would also be curious to see if you all have things in the EHA you think we need to fix or that would make the process go smoother or HOST. I don't know if you all have done any analysis now that we're at this point of how has this impacted our housing and is there any ways we need to tweak this policy?
Yeah, it's still early days for implementation of EHA and mandatory affordable housing. Primarily, the main implementation has been the linkage fee, right, for projects and that 1-9 unit, but primarily the 1-2 family projects have been utilizing that part of the ordinance. Otherwise, you know, looking at kind of different periods post, you know, July 1 of 22, a lot of the projects coming in to our work group were commercial projects. There was not a lot of residential because they were all pre-EHA. But we are definitely seeing an uptick in residential projects of various scopes. That's, of course, anecdotal just from kind of point in time checks, but we could always do that type of analysis. But between CPD and HOST, we have monthly implementation meetings. And at this point, we have not identified any specific revisions that we would suggest to the ordinance to make it more effective. HOST, the catalytic team, manages the high impact development plans, negotiated alternatives, all, you know, waiver and reduction requests from the linkage fee. So we're managing all those things and have not identified any proposed changes, but we are always in close communication and kind of keeping a list of projects.
I would love to hear from HOST if how has the process gone and how has this helped or what successes or how are we looking to measure success on this policy?
Yeah, wonderful. Thanks for the question. I'm Laya Mitchell from the Department of Housing Stability, HOST. It's very helpful to have the grace period kind of successfully closed because it does mean that we're fully into our like complete policy implementation phase. And we are working really closely with CPD on how the program's operating, you know, how we can track and report on outcomes over time. Some of the improvements we're doing internally are just more of the process management. Like we created an updated form to make sure that we're getting like exemption information or just some of the tracking components internally. And then as units are built and move on to HOST's compliance team, making sure that we have a really streamlined process where, you know, developers and then down the road sort of housing managers can come to us with questions about how to implement and make sure that families are moving into those units and that we're really successfully, you know, getting through to, you know, providing housing that Denver needs.
I appreciate that. I think something I'm curious to see and maybe a geographical map would be, are people paying out in higher income neighborhoods to not build the affordable housing and only building the affordable housing and continuously in lower income neighborhoods? So that would just be something I would like to see. And just overall, how much are people buying out? How much are we actually getting? And
yeah,
what other measurements of
that.
Success?
We know that answer.
Yeah,
actually.
We do know that answer.
Yeah,
we only have a handful, I think two projects at this point who have elected to pay the fee in lieu. They haven't paid it yet, but they have elected that as their compliance option. So we could certainly pull up, you know, address and council district and those sort of things. I know one's a townhome project.
Yeah, there's just really a handful of fee in lieu projects and they haven't actually paid yet. We did run some numbers at HOST about kind of, you know, affordable housing plans that are in process, you know, as well as approved. And as Emily mentioned, we don't have a lot that have completely finalized because we are still so early in the plan and development and the site development plan process just takes a long time. But we have, as of right, this current moment, like 38 affordable housing plans that are in process, but not fully sort of signed and recorded. But that's a lot. That's a lot right now. And then we have 5 high impact development compliance plans. So those, you know, larger sites with significantly more units usually. We have 5 of those that are like in process right now, but not completely finalized. To date with the project, we've had 3 high impact development compliance plans signed. So we have 3 completely finalized, 5 still kind of in moving towards finalization. So there is quite a bit of promising activity about numbers of units that are committed. Of those 38, it puts us just over 400 units that would come out of those kind of 38, you know, site-specific affordable housing plans that are currently sort of in process. And some of those may fall away, which is really natural. Some projects get a little ways down the road and then say, no, we're not going to build right now. We're going to hold onto the land and maybe develop next year. But it's still a pretty promising amount of units.
I appreciate that. I would love to get some kind of data of why people aren't building, what are the reasons, and how we can get them back to building the housing. What would it take? So that would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Committee Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Alvidrez. And I'll quickly add, I know that HOST is in the process of their 5-year plan. There is an anecdotal communication on forecasting for housing starts and the impacts based on the prior 5-year plan. And the expectations of EHA has been a part of that and should be in it. And then the annual action plan process should have some of that clear data. And so I think what you've elevated absolutely within the action plan for this year, that's some of the stuff that I know that has been in prior action plans. And we can have that listed out. Not we, I'm not at HOST. They can have that listed out a little more clearly.
Great, thank you.
Councilmember Torres and then Councilmember Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to make sure it's clear when we're talking about grace period projects, we're talking about the projects that tried to get in before EHA was applied. So these are all projects that would not have had any affordability requirement obligated to them. And so I know we saw that number skyrocket. So I'm really glad to see kind of where it's kind of landed with 53% going through and 46% either being closed or deemed inactive. It feels like it affirms for me the unseriousness of a lot of those applications. They were not very serious. They were just trying to get in before we required affordability on site. So, so I appreciate knowing what that number is. What amount of time deems something inactive?
So typically it's 180 days.
Of 6 months.
And then there's actually a 30-day window that they've been notified they've hit 180 okay. days. So they have 210 days to keep their project alive. And then starting in May of 24, that changed to 90 days for the remaining projects.
Got it.
So okay. They received notification at 60 days, and then at 90, they were closed. And we only had 21 projects yeah. that hit that threshold.
Okay, that's it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Councilmember Torres. Councilmember Hines.
Thank you, Committee Chair. You listed the number of SDPs that were approved by Council District. What about the number of units? I know that when we had originally passed DHA and then we're considering the extension and then a second extension, we were told that there was significant number of units. I want to say like 41,000 units or something like that. So obviously, I think to Council Torres's point, some of these were just developers throwing stuff against the wall because they had a deadline and they wanted to see. I mean, I know for sure one applicant in District 10 applied twice for the same plot. So to your point about unseriousness, there were some things that were just applied because they wanted to see if they could beat EHA. But I'd be curious to, and I totally understand you're not going to calculate on the fly, but in addition to Councilmember Alvidrez's question, it'd be nice to know the number of units that were ultimately built because those were, I mean, I remember considering the extension. I remember kind of toiling over the loss of affordable units to gain raw housing units. So the traditional economist would say any unit is a good unit, regardless of where it is in the spectrum, because you know, people will take that, and then people will take where they that person moved out of, and you know, it'll trickle down. We've also seen that you know, many of the units that were built recently were kind of at least market rate, if not luxury units. And so, anyways, I'd be curious about to know the number of units, because I think that would help me kind of as I think about voting for those extensions. Then also, you said how many applications did you say have come forward? 36, because of that are now subject to EJ.
Yeah, fully completed, you know, recorded, executed agreements. There are 15 affordable housing plans and negotiated alternatives that have been approved, at least as the current set of data, and 3 high impact development compliance plans. So 15 from EHA, past grace period or not grace period eligible projects, so required to comply with EHA projects. 15 recorded to date. We have another 38 in process, so a pretty significant jump. So I think we'll be able to see in the coming months and years a lot more sort of impact of these units. And as the projects are built and, you know, households in Denver are able to move into those units, we'll be able to see that impact increasing over time.
And there's a bit of a lull after July 2022, I think is when we passed EHA. I also know that interest rates went up in that time significantly. I know that there were a lot of projects greenlit, and developers wanted to understand the impact of those completed developments before. This is a bit of market uncertainty if Denver could absorb the additional units. And then there's also federal uncertainty too. I wonder how much of an impact those things and maybe others had on the pause. Because I'll throw this out. I feel pretty strongly that when you compare the quarter before EHA was passed and the quarter after EHA was passed, and I heard that a lot from the business community, development community, that it was a precipitous drop. Well, yeah, I think it was because people were throwing stuff against the wall. Like, again, sometimes multiple plans for the same plot. And so I just, my theory that I'm trying to ask is, was it because EHA was passed, or is it because there are all these other forces of like increased interest rates that kind of created that pause? And also we had a whole bunch of applications, and I mean, you're not going to then throw 2 applications for the same plot and then another application a month later. So anyway, I just wanted to get a sense of how much of this was because EHA was passed and how much of it was other things.
I think the initial influx was because of EHA, right? That's the market adjusting to their pro formas. And I think beyond that, it would probably be somewhat difficult to predict the pipeline of projects and why or why not they're coming in, or why they get to a certain point in their plan review process and then don't move forward. Because even with a lot of these grace period projects, it doesn't mean that they will all get built. It does not mean that they will all move forward and obtain a building permit. Most of them were focused on their site plan and not on their building permit. So due to changing market forces, it remains to be seen that they are still feasible. But they have locked in their entitlement to the linkage fee. And we've already even fielded requests from several projects about wanting to make changes, or somebody's wanting to buy my entitlements. And, you know, what does that mean? Can they actually do that? Well, what if they want to make these types of changes? Are they still locked in? So I think it was both, but initially just the adoption of the ordinance, and then beyond that, just the market conditions is what we heard.
Yeah, I would just chime in too if I can, which is, you know, we don't have official survey data on why projects, you know, don't move forward or But the increased interest rates, the cost of capital, has a huge impact across the board. And so I do think we're seeing that in residential development in Denver. That's the data we have is really pointing to that. And we did do a look at the amount of impact on a pro forma of increased interest rates, as well as cost of construction, which went up. There's a lot of uncertainty in construction costs over the last few years, and particularly the interest rates, the impact on a project of that versus the EHA requirements, which can have a sort of a minor effect on a pro forma, the cost of capital, the increased interest rates is the amount of change that can really make a project move from feasibility to unfeasible, or to basically no longer be able to pencil. Whereas like the impact of the inclusionary units is quite minor in comparison to the pretty significant cost that interest rates have on projects. And Denver is seeing that the way that cities across the country have that same trend.
The year before EHA was passed in June of 2021, I was the sponsor of the text amendment in Golden Triangle that set the standard of affordability in Denver is 60% of the area median income instead of 80%. And that was a stakeholder process. And that stakeholder process became so contentious, we could not move forward with stakeholder processes. And people were just unwilling. They just like took up all the oxygen in the room. They said, no, we can't talk about anything else because 60% affordability is just, which, you know, can't move forward. So I took a lot of lumps. You know, EHA then took 60% of the area median income in Golden Triangle and applied it citywide. I personally took a lot of lumps saying that I was killing housing development in Denver by saying yes to 60% AMI because projects couldn't pencil, and then took more lumps, with the EHA citywide. And I still see cranes. I still see there aren't as many starts right now. I know that there are three projects in Golden Triangle that are waiting for the market to kind of unwind because there have been so many units come online in Golden Triangle just the last couple of years. But I guess I'm trying to do a little bit of my own reconciliation because I took so many lumps. I truly felt at the time that it was the right thing to do to pass enhanced housing affordability. I thought it was the right thing to do to redefine affordability as 60% of the area median income. And I guess as we do this this debrief of the EHA grace period, that's also what I'm trying to. We're on camera, so I'm not trying to get you to say on the record I made the right vote, but those are just kind of some of the reason why I'm asking the questions about the data, the number of units, and the number of applications now. Just trying to help me reconcile: did I screw up, or am I okay? I think I'm okay, but anyway, that's the nature of the question.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing development activity pick back up, but in a different way, I think. I think all developers are having to make decisions based on cost of land, cost of tariffs, cost of all of the things, but I don't think that the inclusionary zoning is necessarily their biggest concern anymore. Because we do have multifamily being proposed in concept, in site plan. I mean, it's there, and we have a lot of that 1-9 unit development as well. I would say, like, again, that initial pipeline after June 1 of 22 was mostly commercial, then the 1-9 unit, and now we're starting to see like the multifamily trickling back in.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Councilmember Hines. Thank you so much, Emily and team and host, for all the work that you did. That was a large amount of requests that you needed to review. There were some specific timelines, not created by yourselves, but created through the legislative process that was necessary to make sure we move through those. And I think the work that you did, the transparency you provided to us, and then for us to be able to provide to our constituents, I think was extremely helpful. So thank you very much. Thank you for the briefing, and we look forward for additional information. As Councilmember Alvizares has asked for, there's lots of data to mine, and I know that you all have processes to do that and to elevate that to us. I want to thank Alyssa, Luke, and Heather also for making sure these meetings run. So thank you all for your work. We have 9 items on consent. None are pulled off. This meeting's adjourned.